Hi, everyone. I'm David Culver, Vice President of Government and Stakeholder Relations at Canopy Growth. Welcome back to Under the Canopy. I'm excited to introduce you to an amazing guest this week, Toy Hutchinson, who is a former Illinois State Senator, former President of the National Conference of State Legislatures, and now serves as the Senior Advisor to the Governor on Cannabis Control, a job that was quickly dubbed the Potzer. A Democrat from South Suburban Olympia Fields, Toy spent a decade in the state Senate before resigning her seat to take the new job in the administration. She's been a fierce advocate for Illinois' cannabis law to have a strong social justice framework, including provisions that allow people to have low-level marijuana convictions expunged and measures designed to help minority-owned business enter the industry. And as you've seen in the news, the state's decision to legalize has been a very profitable one in terms of tax revenue and business development. It's been an exciting state to watch. Toy is also one to watch in the cannabis industry, and I consider myself lucky to call her a friend. It's an honor to have all of you with us here today. Under the Canopy, of course. Please enjoy the discussion. Senator, great to see you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Under the Canopy. I very much wish that we were sitting at someplace fun in Chicago with some of our cronies having a glass of wine, but we are here on Zoom. But nonetheless, nice to see you. How are you and your family doing?
We're making it. It's a global pandemic, but here in my house, we're intergenerational. So I have my baby adult children, which I call them that because they're just launching. And my mother and our dog. So my husband's a saint. So everybody's really good.
Good. Well, you look great. And I'm glad everybody is well in your family. And again, thank you so much for taking some time to joining us. We're really excited, as is the whole Canopy team, to have you today to speak with us on a whole host of things. So why don't we go ahead and dive in? You have had quite a year, and you have gone from very successful state senator in Illinois, president of NCSL, very popular in state capitals all across the country. You are now cannabis czar, advising Governor Pritzker on all things cannabis. And you've done all this, as you referenced, in the middle of a pandemic. So how's the year been? How's the first 7 months? Tell me everything.
Well, you know, it's... I think the biggest surprise I think for people is that we were waiting to see whether cannabis sales would be impacted by COVID. And we've proven here in Illinois, even with our small program, that it's recession proof and it's pandemic proof. So our numbers in terms of our sales have been just through the roof. We went live in January, and you know, to a lot of fanfare, and there wasn't really a way to determine what it was going to look like when it happened. But it landed like thunder heard around the world, because even when we were preparing for any anger or any cynicism or any political fights we had to put out, you saw happy people standing in line, giving each other hot chocolate and food trucks pulling up and lines around the block that was sustained through really, really heavy winter Chicago days all the way up and down through the state. So it's been an incredible experience. Even at the same time, while we're waiting with bated breath to see how our equity measures stand up to, you know, this licensure process. We've had some delays because of COVID that impacted all governmental processes and procedures. And that's been difficult for the people who are really waiting to see if they got a shot, you know, in this industry. But overall, I learned something new every single day. And being someone who left an elected position to come over to the administration side for the implementation, I'm going to have a PhD in weed by the time all this stuff is over. So it's been incredible.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm glad you're having fun. Sounds like you're having fun. Obviously the newspaper headlines have been amazing for the state. So congratulations there. You touched on the economics of cannabis. Let's get into that first a little bit deeper if we could. I've seen the newspaper reports talking about tax revenue, talking about sales figures. From that perspective, it's been unusually successful.
Comment, if you would, a little bit more on that. And also, are you hearing from other states that are thinking about this? And just for those reasons, as budget deficits have ballooned across the country.
Well, we made a very conscious effort in Illinois to be as our policy goal that we were not doing this to make as much money as fast as we possibly could. We were actually doing this for people. So our entire program is based on equity. It's based on the fact that we're normalizing and legalizing an activity for whom the prohibition of the same activity destroyed whole communities for multiple generations. So if we really were looking at this for like the economic boom, we probably would be seeing a lot more money inuring to the state as a result of this. And what we decided to do was have an equity principle at every single measure of this program that's three-pronged. It is, how do you change the face of the industry? What do you do with the money? And how do you undo past harms? That's the center of everything we do here in Illinois as it relates to this. It's what got me into this whole conversation in the first place. So right now, when I see receipts that are as high as they are, I know that 25% of those dollars are going to be reinvested back into communities that were hardest hit by drugs. And that means when I say hardest hit, not only from a patient perspective or an individual citizen perspective, but the things that go along with that, like disinvestment in communities and undereducation and underemployment and high rates of crime. There's no way to look at equity as only the licensure, because that's a huge thing. When you have new entrants into a marketplace, settled in communities, settled in neighborhoods, that has a ripple effect everywhere else. That's who gets to do the marketing and who gets to do the HVAC and who gets to install the internet things, who gets to be the lawyer, all those things that the industry needs can be grown around communities that have traditionally and historically been locked up and locked out. Then our criminal justice aspect of this has to go with that. It has to. And so we've identified 770,000 criminal records to be expunged over the next 5 years. And then when you put that, you layer that on top of how you reinvest in communities, then the receipts that are coming, even though the receipts are happening before we've gotten the equity licenses out, which is in process right now, you can't take one leg off of that three-legged stool. Equity is all three of those things. And that's why I'm so proud. I am so very proud that now in the United States, because Illinois was able to actually be the first state to embed this in the law as a policy of the state with all those wonderful words like, whereas, we find. Nobody else can pass this around the country without having equity attached to it. That is a monumental change in not only drug policy reform, but criminal justice reform and our case study in reinvesting in communities. I can't wait to see how this turns out. And I'm just incredibly proud to be a part of the conversation at all.
Well, you should be proud of that, because I think the work is so important and critical. I really feel like what you've done in Illinois with the governor is model legislation for what other states should consider as they go through this. But let me ask you along those same lines about the federal government. The House of Representatives passed a policing package that the Congressional Black Caucus wrote, and that did not include any sort of decriminalization of cannabis in the package. I've asked leaders of the caucus about this. And I'm just curious how we can be thinking about policing reform, criminal justice reform on the federal level without talking about cannabis. What are your thoughts about that?
I definitely think that this space is an area that wraps up so many different things that have layers of connection. It's those intersections we talk about on the ground. And it really is why we came to this the way we came to this. Now, when you hear people talking about cannabis, and this is what's really, really important, because it goes to removing the hypocrisy around the plant. It goes to removing the stigma around this plant. We know that there are communities that have been impacted the most by the war on drugs. We know that's 55% African American and upwards of 24 to 30% of Latinx communities. So we know what those statistics are. And a lot of people understand that the United States history with drug policy is layered with a number of different structural racist things that need to be dismantled. And if there's anything we've seen in the last 5 months that goes along with the irony of the fact that this year is 2020 and 2020 stands for perfect vision, is that we need to be seeing things differently. We need to look at this differently. And when you take this subject matter and say, okay, we're normalizing and legalizing in one space. We have people who find it easy to discuss the criminal justice stuff or the criminal justice reform parts of it, and then turn away from the fact that upwards of 34 states have a legal thriving industry in some form, either medical or adult use or both. And our entire federal apparatus is silent on it. That's astounding. And so on behalf of the advocates who've been in this space in the United States for as long as they have been, when no one was listening, when no political person was listening, you know, if you remember back when Bill Clinton said, yeah, but I didn't inhale, all the way up to Barack Obama, who said, I thought that was the point. Like, our conversation is changing today. And, you know, there's so much work that we need to do. But luckily, we've been able to do these little things that we used to call in NCSL laboratories of democracy, each state trying to figure out how to do this. And so I'm encouraged that the conversation has gone as far as it's gone. I'm encouraged that it's no longer a hard thing to talk about when you talk about equity in this space. And I'm encouraged that now people who never used to talk about this are having, you know, these things just kind of roll off into the conversation plate right now at all levels of government, all over the place. And then you start to see that we're really close to finding all kinds of new things, all kinds of new treatments for ailments that have bothered people for so long, for chronic pain, for cancer research, for epileptic seizures, for, you know, all kinds of things that are the people of this country deserve to have research to show and deserve to have resources and money and things like that go into figuring out plant-based medicine. That is an incredibly exciting time. And then you look at, there's an opportunity here to make generational wealth happen for communities who could not participate in this. Mm-hmm. And that's significant. Like, I remember seeing it was actually a chart. It was about John Johnson when he owned Ebony and Jet magazine based in Chicago. And it had all of the lines that went to all the businesses he created because he existed, you know, and what that did to the Black middle class, that, you know, all the people who worked at Johnson Publishing, all the people, you know, that got lawyer, you know, legal contracts, the people who were the accountants, the folks that did the marketing, the people who did that, like he created a whole universe of people who had economic advantages because Johnson Publishing was there when it was and could hire and was intentional about the way it spent its money. That is absolutely something that is true in the cannabis space right now. So when we start looking at this, it's not just about whether or not you own a dispensary or a cultivation center. It is really about all of the ancillary businesses that also come along with that while we're rebuilding communities and changing people's lives by giving them a chance to have a second start, whether they touch the plant at all. That's a thing that's so exciting about this space, that it means so much more than just what people laugh and joke about. Like, you see this is in every movie, it's in every television show, it's fodder for humor, you know, across so many different lines of mass communication in our culture right now. But when it comes to the people who are impacted the most by the prohibition of this, then we only talk about crime. That has to stop. That has to stop. And so when we have good corporate actors and we have people who are willing to take this fight up from wherever they are, like, you can bloom where you're planted, whether you work in a cannabis company itself, or if you understand where you could be volunteering in your communities. If you're a lawyer yourself, you could volunteer to do expungement workshops. We've had a number of different big law firms that will give folks, you know, people who need to do pro bono work, the chance to get trained on how to help somebody through an expungement process. We still live in a time where 800,000 people across this country a year are arrested for cannabis. And of those stops, the majority of them are for possession. So we have a long way to go to undo 80 years of really horrible drug policy. But this is a long game, and I think we're in the planning season right now.
Toy, let me just a final question on this topic. If you're sitting in the boardroom of Canopy Growth, or you're sitting with one of the operators in the state of Illinois, and you're helping them to understand how they should be responding to this, how they should be acting at the moment, both individually and as a corporation. What are you telling? What are you telling people?
Normally, I start with the premise that we are talking about normalizing and legalizing something that the prohibition of the same activity did incredible amounts of harm. Start there. That needs to be acknowledged across the board. The other thing is that from a company perspective, embedding principles of equity throughout the company, like not allowing measures of equity and diversity and inclusion to just be one-offs, offshoots, but to actually take those principles and embed them so that people can see really what the goals and the ethics of the company are. I always talk about, like, during Women's History Month, and I get bombarded with lots of pink products because I'm a girl, and I guess I just only like pink, and they throw pink products at us. I want to know who's in your C-suite. I want to know who's in your boardroom, because that lens matters when you talk about embedding principles throughout an organization. And so I usually start from that point. And then we talk about the differences between equity and diversity and inclusion. Both are necessary, but they are not the same thing. And there needs to be a fair amount of education about that. Equity in the cannabis space really is, we are legalizing something that used to be illegal and shut whole folks out. Those folks need to be made whole. Diversity and inclusion means we want the organization, or we want wherever we are, to look like where the country where we are, to look like where the people live, look like really representative of who we are. Both things are important, but they're not the same. And they're not the same when you really understand the history of drug policy in this country. So usually those kinds of conversations start off like that. And then you can have a fulsome thing as to what we can do. And that also means getting really comfortable having sometimes uncomfortable conversations, because you can't fix what you don't see.
Yeah, well said. I'm very curious about your thoughts related to the passing of civil rights icon, Representative John Lewis. I had the pleasure to meet him many, many times during my career in Washington. Just such an important figure in our nation's history. What can you tell me about Representative Lewis?
I just think that one, besides being a gentle giant, I would hope that at some point, when someone's looking back at the breadth of what my life and career was, that there would be people who would say that my time here was as meaningful as his was. It is really important for us to remember, especially now when civil unrest and protest, you know, is happening globally. And this is actually kind of emotional. We tend to come at this like protest should be polite, and we want it to be peaceful all the time. And that's because we don't want to be uncomfortable, because protest has never been calm and polite. And Congressman Lewis survived nearly dying on that Edmund Pettus Bridge in a peaceful protest. And I want to make that really clear. They were being peaceful, and they were met with violence. The civil rights movement was built on so many people who believed that if we could just tell the story, show the thing, and that was what was so powerful about learning how to meet violence with nonviolent resistance. That's what was really, really powerful about it, because then you could see where hate and anger were. This man lived his life with still physical ailments from that encounter all those years ago. So when someone like that tells you that when you see an injustice, don't be afraid to get in trouble, because sometimes you need a little good trouble, is largely why we're doing the work that we're doing. This is, again, a moment in time where we need to see things differently. And when I look at who he was and what he stood for and what he was unafraid to confront, it makes me wonder, when I look at my children, what would I have been doing at the height of the civil rights movement? Who would I have been? Could I have watched my children stand in the face of hoses and dogs? Could I have sent my husband to be willing to sit and desegregate a lunch counter? Would I have been brave enough to stand in the gap like that, the way so many people did and so many young people did? Because you think about how old John Lewis was when that happened. He was, you know, it's not that he may not have felt fear, but, you know, being a freedom rider was taking that fear and moving through it. And so when I think about who I would have been in that time period, the best indication of that is, who are we now in the height of this civil rights movement? How are we getting into some good trouble? And the only way I can answer that now is that I am choosing to do this. I chose to put my reputation and all my political capital on the line to say that the way we do cannabis policy in the United States is unacceptable and cannot go on a day longer. Anytime anybody told us to slow down, I don't know how slow 80 years of failed policy could be, or how many hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives and livelihoods over this war, which really was born on people. So when I think about what he left and what that means for those of us that have to keep going, I think, thank God that there was a John Lewis. And because there was a John Lewis, that's how you could get a Toy Hutchinson.
Well, that is beautifully said. Thank you, Senator. And I'm going to leave it there, because I don't know that we can get more powerful than that particular comment. I am so grateful to you for being with us, for joining the Under the Canopy series. This is something, again, that our entire company is excited about. I'm excited for folks to get to know you better. If you don't hear it enough, on behalf of the entire cannabis industry, thank you for all that you do. And I'm just really grateful to call you a friend. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was wonderful.